Welcome to the talk show worth talking about, Healing Stigma on Left of Straight Radio, with your co-hosts, Kevin Hogan, founder of the Healing Stigma Program, and Scott Fullerton, voice of Left of Straight Radio. From A-list entertainers to hometown heroes, join Kevin and Scott as they interview those on the cutting edge of challenging stigma, with insight, humor, and always compassion. Give them your ears and they'll open your mind. For positive talk with positive results, you're listening to Healing Stigma on Left of Straight Radio. Now here are your hosts, Scott and Kevin.
Welcome everybody. It is Thursday, September 29th. I can't believe the month's already over. Welcome to Healing Stigma on Left of Straight Radio. I am your host, Scott Fulton, along as always my co-host, Kevin. Kevin, how are you doing today?
Oh my goodness, there is so much to talk about. Thursday couldn't get here quick enough, my friend. That's what it's like.
I bet you've had an exciting week. Talk about your Monday. I talked about it on my other radio shows and kind of shout out you were there. But let's let all of our Healing Stigma listeners know what's been going on.
Well, thank you so much. It was a really fun and wonderful third trip for me personally to be invited to go to the White House as part of the bisexual celebrations of Bisexual Awareness Week. And this one actually was a community briefing that was, how can I say this? We've done a lot of work with, you know, making lawmakers aware of, you know, what the needs and issues might be, dealing with everything from, you know, homelessness, violence against bisexuals, the idea of how visibility and education can help break down things like stigma. And these can be very heavy issues. You know, I mean, we've talked about them on the show before, and it can get clinical at times, even though these things have to be said and researched so that, you know, the idea of a bisexual on a survey, that there's a box there so they don't get erased, you know, or you know, that, sure, you know, whatever you're paying for is actually done. And these things are going on, trust me. But this one was different in a sense, because along with panels and talking about where we're going to go, because I'll tell our listeners this, Washington is an amazing place right now, and being in the White House right now with all of the things that aren't being spoken of that are, you know, just in politics right now, the urgency about it didn't take away. It actually, I think, made this particular visit really amazing, because we also had artistic performances as well as thought leaders. So, you know, from culture to science to lawmakers all shared the stage. And the difference was this time it was all live streamed, you know, over the WhiteHouse.gov channel. And I'm so thrilled to say that I was asked to read a poem from Maitri Estrad, the collection that I've spoken and been so, you know, pleased on the show to have people enjoy and give feedback on or whatever. But it was really touching for me to be able to share that stage with so many people that are, you know, true heroes in my eyes, and colleagues and activists of the highest caliber. You know, I can't mention everyone right now, but I'll say this. There's a couple of people I just want to call out, which is Faith Cheltenham, the, you know, president of Binet USA and a co-founder of so many things like Biweek and all the rest. I think she's going to be on the show. She was, you know, kind of the MC she's one of the groundbreaking people for this whole entire, all of these visits, along with my dear friend Ellen Rustrom of Speak Out Boston. But to be up there with Faith and to see how she handled this in such an amazing way with grace and a celebration, as I said, without necessarily knowing what's going to happen soon, that calling together those people, that inspiration to go forward from there and continue the work regardless of what happens, as well as knowing that we have work to do, you know, right now, today, that was really an honor to be part of that. And we'll share, you know, we'll get it out there. Our listeners can actually go on the site and see the whole entire thing, and we can give instructions to where my reading was and all the rest. But in the meantime, yeah, thank you, Scott. It was truly, truly an honor, and D.C. is an amazing place right now. The energy there is electric.
That is awesome. Now, do you have actual legislators, elected House or Senate members come to these things to support it, or are you able to talk about who's out there now that are being part of this?
Thank you. Thank you, because I said I was going to mention some other people. There is I'm honored to call her a friend, Rafi Friedman Gerspan. You can look up her on the probably the White House site. She's the senior associate director for the White House Office of Public Engagement. Earlier was here in Massachusetts, was a key person in putting the Massachusetts transgender rights bill through. You know, getting it written, all the rest. So this is the idea of what I'm saying is, yes, the movers and shakers, the people on both sides from government. I mean, it was an earlier one of these on my second visit that I actually met and was able to start serving on the trauma informed for, you know, the multi-faith congregations as a stigma expert for, you know, developing resiliency and making sure that we respond to trauma victims in a caring, compassionate way and don't wind up stigmatizing them. I met that leader from the Department of Health and Human Services on my second visit to the White House. So every time I've met people from .gov, as well as, and that's why it's such an interesting mixing point. You know, we have one of the great things, if you watch the whole thing, you see so many other artists there, people of color from our movement that are also, let's say, know the fact that I thought that it was an amazing point on the stage when people were talking about the idea of Black Lives Matter, as well as Black Trans Lives Matter, as well as Black Bi Lives Matter, as well as Black Lesbian Lives. You know, so we would start doing this and realizing that all of these things, that sometimes even within a community, that oftentimes, you know, for our own, bisexuals, if a person who is also a person of color happens to be bisexual, the violence rate, the homeless rate, these things begin to double, because then, and it's horrible, people can be double or triply stigmatized. You know, imagine being homeless, bisexual, and a person of color, and you're looking for that, you know, that ability to turn your identity into a whole and good thing when everyone is trying to break your identity down and tell you that you're something you're not. It's horrible. And that's why in that room, the idea of having not just, say, you know, lawmakers, but the idea this time of having performers and people singing and people sharing their poetry, as well as panels. Yeah, I'd encourage people to watch, you know, at least to glance more. I'm not just doing it for me. Watch it. It's an amazing thing that the White House has put together, community building. And that's a huge part of what Healing Stigma is about. And Scott, I don't know. I don't think you've seen this yet, but Healing Stigma was actually put there along with my poetry on the program for what I was contributing. So the idea that, you know, there is a poet is one thing, but I was very honored that the White House decided to call out the Healing Stigma program. So I want to say that thank you on air for doing that. And again, that's another thing that Rafi is so good at doing. And we might have more, certainly we'll have more to come on that, as well as the local things we've been doing here in Massachusetts to try and get, you know, hate crimes and other things like that, recognizing how bisexuality is something that can be reported and is something to be proud about and not stigmatize people for, as well as the rest of the rainbow community, of course.
That was awesome. So proud of you. So glad that went through. That's awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, the energy you can tell is still there. So I'm sharing it, but it was a great week of celebrations. And how was yours? What are you up to, my friend? Because I know you're all over the place.
I am all over the place. I am road tripping through New England, as my hashtag is on social media. But, I mom and I like to she's getting near the big 8-0, so we're trying to travel while she still can. So this is one
place
she hasn't been in a while, and she's wanted to go to watch the leaves change and check out a couple places. So we started out Monday on a 1.5-week tour. We're going to be back maybe next Friday, I think, or next Thursday.
Oh, great.
And it's been a fun trip so far. Been interesting. And, of course, you know me, anything that can happen to me usually does happen to me. So it's had a couple of hiccups along the way. We've had some great shows on the road. So the Left is Right shows, we did the first night from Verona, New York. And
cool.
On Tuesday night show last, we did from Massachusetts. We did it from Sturbridge, Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah.
And then,
out in the West. Yeah.
Exactly. And then Wednesday's show.
Were the leaves changing yet? Or was it too early, do you think?
There's some spots. It's not all over, but there's some spots. They're starting to happen. I think it probably will by the time we leave, because if you blink, it's going to miss it. But there's some good-looking leaf spots. I put a little bit up on social media. There are some great ones. Last night I had, of course, our good friend Jennifer Bernardi, who portrays Tiggy.
So Tiggy Eplin
was on the show on Standing on My Soapbox. We talked about politics.
I'm going to check that out.
Talked about Bisexuality Week as well on that for pop culture, and she brought a lot to the table on that, so that was really good. Then tonight I am calling in from the beautiful city of Chester, Vermont. It is cool, but it's like I said, anything that can happen, right? So we kind of, we wanted to go to Vermont for a couple things. One of the things my mom wanted to see is the Vermont Old Country Store that the magazines go out to and everything. They have a lot of really cool stuff. So it's out here, and there's a couple places in Vermont that it's at. So we picked one that was a good amount of drive so we can check in tonight. And we've kind of been doing this on the fly, right? We didn't really make it. The first night we made reservations, and we're just playing by ear. So we get to this place, and we get to the Vermont Country Store, and we go, okay, I got to find someplace close by so we can do the show tonight and get a bite to eat and relax. Lo and behold, on my little hotels.com app, come on, be a sponsor, hotels.com. On my little hotels.com spot, what pops up just 6 miles away, but get this, the Fullerton Inn. So we are here tonight at the Fullerton Inn in Chester, Vermont. But unfortunately, it's from the cheap side of the Fullerton family.
But you didn't have to buy the place to put your name on it. You didn't have to buy the place to put your name on it.
I'm taking some cool pictures. It's a gorgeous inn in Chester, but it's an older inn. So, of course, you know me, I'm a big guy, and mom is, the knees aren't that great getting up there in the late 70s. We're on the third floor in a walk-up. There's no elevator in this inn. On a third floor walk-in, and then we get in the room, and
that's
there's
called
no
quaint
TV
New England
room,
charm.
So we
that's called
really
quaint New England charm.
About driving for 10 hours a day. We have no TVs tonight, and there was no air conditioner. So it's crazy.
Yeah, no, that's quaint New England charm. And you know what's worse? I can tell you what quaint Irish bed and breakfast charm is, but I also, and I can't get bad about this because I've been in Ireland to some of the most beautiful spots as well. Really, I mean it. But I know because I've been off the beaten track at times and had to find some, you know, just truly amazing spots that were, it was a bed and it was a breakfast and it was nothing else.
It was a fun, cute hotel. And just to add spookiness to it, the person, the innkeeper, actually is from where my mom grew up in Richmond, Indiana. How winky dinky is that?
Did you guys find out who the Fullertons are there? Is there any kind of relationship? Are you going to find some kind of lost?
Honestly, we got in here like an hour and a half before the show. We had a nice meal in the restaurant that's included, which was very nice.
And we went
upstairs to our room here, and I'm just happy that it has Wi-Fi so we can do our show tonight. Yay!
Good, okay.
That's a happy thing.
All right, well, you could be staying in a distant relative's, you know, place right now. This could be more. So we'll have to listen more as what this goes on, and I'll have to help you off the after the show or whatever. We'll connect because obviously I've been so busy, but you're now in, you know, kind of getting into the neck of the woods where I know stuff. But I got to tell you, man, you're definitely getting the quaint New England charm, and that's kind of the fun part of it, getting off the beaten path and seeing what's out there. It's amazing.
And it's fun. That's why we didn't make any reservations. So let's go ahead and get right to it, though, because I know we have Richard standing on. We can't wait to get him on. We're going to go ahead and play a quick musical break here. Our good friend Brandon and James, they are a vocal cello duo. They're going to be on the show soon. They started a hashtag campaign launch this week. It's hashtag you belong, hashtag YOU belong. It is to erase labels and to just do a gender equality and LGBT equality and every just human equality. They put a music video together that launched this Monday, and they are just doing a fantastic job. They're actually in Panama right now as we speak, but we're going to have them on the show to talk about their diversity and this great You Belong. But let's play, speaking of, just for the heck, we'll play the Hotel California since we're talking about my hotel situation here. But when we come back, we're going to be talking to the amazing Richard Schneider of the Gay and Lesbian Review. Listen to Kevin and I on Healing Stigma on Left of Straight Radio. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
your shimmering light. I had you heavy and my sight grew dim. I had to stop for the night. There she stood in the doorway. I heard the mission bell. I was thinking to myself, this could be heaven or this could be hell. Then she lit up the candle and she showed me the way. There were voices down the corridor. I thought I heard them say, welcome to the Hotel California. Such a lovely place. Such a lovely place. Tiffany twisted. She got a Mercedes fit. She got a lot of pretty, pretty boys that she calls friends. How they dance in the courtyard. Sweet summer sweat. Some dance to remember. Some dance to forget. So I called up the captain. Please bring me my wine, he said. We haven't had that spirit here since 1969. And still those voices are calling from far away. Wake you up in the middle of the night just to hear them say, welcome to the Hotel California. Such a lovely place. Such a lovely day. Plenty of room at the Hotel California. Any time of year, you can find us here.
And we are back. That is Brandon and James. Do yourself a favor, guys. Go to YouTube, look up Brandon and James, hashtag you belong. They made this amazing video from people all over the world that sent in the submissions of different labels that have been assigned to them, queer, obese, not pretty, things like that. And then you turn it over and it's I belong because everyone does belong. So very awesome. Good on them. And I'm looking forward to having them on the show very soon. Today, Kevin and I are really happy to have a guest. He is the founder, editor, and de facto publisher of the original Harvard Gay and Lesbian Review. It started back in 1994 and is now a five-monthly magazine targeting the educated readership of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities. Does under the tagline of Bi-Monthly Journal of History, Culture, and Politics, and there's essays in a wide range of disciplines, as well as reviews of books, movies, and plays. He also writes regularly for the site, and we are so excited to have him on this show tonight. Please welcome Richard Schneider. Richard, how are you tonight?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for coming on, my friend. How is everything with you?
Oh, everything is great here. Let's see, I just went to press with the latest issue, so I'm feeling a little bit more laid back than I was last week. I think
Hillary
did great in the debate.
Kevin, congratulations, Richard. Congratulations. I know how hard you guys work around your deadline, so well done.
Oh, yes. It gets crazy. We're bi-monthly magazine, and I would say we have about 2 weeks out of every 2 months that are, you know, nutty. And
yeah.
The rest of the time is still nutty, but not as bad.
Hey, can I stop here for a sec? Because I interrupt all the time, Richard. You'll understand that now in the podcast. But first of all, I can tell in our viewers, I mean our listeners, yeah, viewers, I'm getting ahead of ourselves. But our listeners are really going to be in for a treat here, because I've also had the opportunity and the honor to be a contributing writer for the Gay and Lesbian Review. And I can tell you that Richard works so hard because he gives incredible attention to literally, I'm sure, every writer as well as myself. So in the process, thank you, because what you do both – this new issue I can't wait to ask you about, because it's really exciting, and I'm sure the next one is even more exciting. But what you do for the community is also on each and every single one of these, given meticulous focus and detail. And in a world where so many things are – you know, as a writer, you see so many things aren't – we're talking about fact-checking lately, right? So many things aren't right. I just applaud what you do with really meticulous detail. And thanks so quickly after that deadline, now taking the time to come on here, because we're really excited to have you. So just really hats off to you and all compliments to what you do so well with amazing energy all through. And now, by the way, I just also want to say this is the Gay and Lesbian Review worldwide. Talking about going from Harvard Review to worldwide, if that's not market development, I don't know what is.
Well, you know, we started out as the Harvard Gay and Lesbian Review in 1994, and we actually came by the name Honestly because we were published by an alumni organization called the Harvard Gay and Lesbian Caucus, and we had that name for 6 years. And then Harvard University came to us and said, well, you know, we like the magazine, but you actually don't have an official connection to the university, so we're afraid you're going to have to change your name. So, which was okay, and we were totally okay with that, actually. We even thought about doing it on our own. But then we thought, well, gosh, after, like, Harvard Gay and Lesbian, like, where do we go from there? That was, like, the early days of the World Wide Web. This was the year 1999.
Right.
And so we thought, well, worldwide is kind of a cool word. So that's basically where we came up with the worldwide. And
yeah,
I have to confess that we're still mostly a U.S. magazine. We're nationally distributed. But we do have some international focus, certainly Canada and other English-speaking countries. We get writers and some subscribers, so we try to be as worldwide as possible.
No, I was just going to say, I think it's one of those things where there are perspectives, and for listeners that are interested in something that really is worth reading, not just for the rainbow community, but I think for anyone that wants to get the perspective on so many events, we're looking at, I think, again, in countries around the world where LGBT rights are of interest to the English-speaking world and are of interest to America, that so many times both leads the way in conversations and clashes in these things. So that's why I think it's a really important publication, and I think the word is well chosen. Where these issues go are worldwide.
Well, you know what? I have to stop you there, because I think you said something really fascinating. The rainbow community, that is perfect. That's what we should call ourselves, because many people don't like the word queer. I mean, we've gotten so many letters. We started out as, you know, back in the day, Gay and Lesbian was good enough. We were the Gay and Lesbian Review.
Right.
And, of course, you know, that seems to exclude other groups, which we don't mean to do. But that's
right.
That's kind of our name. So, you know, there's bisexuals and transgender.
Brand identity.
And then, of course, you know, if you really start adding letters, as we've all seen those strings of letters coming together, that doesn't really work too well either. So we've kind of been agonizing about, oh, gosh, should we change our name? Should we just be, you know, the GLBT review or whatever, or LGBT? But I like that. Rainbow Community. That's, you know, that's what we should be.
Or the Rainbow Review, even. I don't even know if that
the
exists.
Rainbow
I have no
review.
Idea.
That
you know,
great.
I mean, I'm just looking at your current issue, by the way, and it's right on the cover there. You know, you've got when the White House, I was just there, and when the White House was lit up in rainbow colors. So I'm just looking at it, and it just literally came to me as I'm looking at it. So there you go. You use it. Give me credit, and you got it.
I will
you got it,
my friend. I mean, I don't know if it's going to happen. I think it would have to be some
I'm kidding. It's yours. It's yours.
Oh, well,
I love what you do. And anything
Thank
that opens
you.
The
Thank
door,
you.
Language, let's face it, language is important. And I will say that the word queer is so well accepted amongst, you know, younger.
I hear younger
activists coming up, of which I was honored to be in the presence of just recently. But I think, you know, here's the thing, and I get it. For the readership and what you're doing, even a slight change in one word is in something that has been traditional and done in a certain way, because not only have you broken down doors, open doors, but along the way, a lot of this has turned in. I mean, this is a very respectable and I think informed publication. So I think people that, at least for me in the bisexual community, I was honored to be, I didn't feel that I was excluded when I wrote for the Gay and Lesbian Review, although people would ask me, well, you know, are you going to now insist that a B be on the car? I said, no. I said, this is one of those things where I get brand identity as a writer, but I also understand that people talking about it is brilliant. Get curious. Go take a look at it. You know, take a look at one issue and trust me, you're going to want to get more. That's what I say. But in the meantime, I get from your point what agonizing. That's, by the way, that's why it was so important for me to come up with those two words, healing stigma, for the name of my program that obviously now Scott has turned in here. You know, we do as a podcast, but also for what we do for communities and individuals. I had to come up with two words that said it all. And I get it. I get how long and hard of a road that can be.
Oh, well, I mean, our name is already too long, the Gay and Lesbian Review Worldwide. So if we anything we can do to shorten it would actually be all to the good.
Cool.
But anything we did would be very controversial. I mean, if you think about it,
any name that we came
up with would exclude somebody or offend somebody. I mean, we do, I have to admit, we have kind of an older readership. Not exclusively, but we've done a reader survey, and we know that our readers kind of skew toward over 50. And many people, and I'm in that age bracket myself, and I know that the word queer is kind of explosive and not loved by all. So I think that's one that we, you know, can't just
But Rainbow
embrace.
Doesn't have it the same. Yeah, you're right.
It's got,
right,
it's got no negative connotations whatsoever, as far as I know. I mean, it's a beautiful thing, right? Rainbow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We feel included.
Yeah.
Well,
back to the beginnings here for a little bit for you, Richard. I mean, you've been, speaking of Harvard, you have your PhD in sociology from there, and talk about what brought you into the publishing world and what made you think about doing so. Have you always been a writer, or talk about a little of your background?
Well, yes, so I have a doctorate in sociology. So at first, my first career was actually as a college professor, and I did that for 10 years or so for the University of Maryland and then for Alfred University in upstate New York. So that was kind of my first career. And then my second career was as director of research for a consulting firm here in Boston, which it was that was like another 10 years. And it was during that time that I founded the Gay and Lesbian Review, which now we're talking like the mid-90s. And I kept doing that job for the rest of the decade. So for a while, I had like two full-time jobs, which was like I'll always remember that as like the, you know, the craziest time of my life was like basically the 90s. not that it's, you know, it's somewhat more relaxed now. So the way that I got into like why did I found the GLR in 1994? So I got involved with the Harvard Gay and Lesbian Caucus in, I think, 1987. I lived in Europe for 5 years, actually. And then when I came back, somebody recruited me.
I've lived in Europe for many years. I get it, my friend.
Oh,
I get it. You're speaking to – you're preaching to the faithful. Go ahead.
Oh, it was great. It was wonderful. So when I came back, a very good friend, my closest and best friend, recruited me to be in this alumni organization of
yeah.
Harvard, which was the Harvard Gay and Lesbian Caucus, and specifically to do their newsletter because they really desperately needed somebody to do it. So I think 8 or 9 years or something, I was the editor of the newsletter, and that's kind of how I learned how to be an editor and how I learned how to do, like, because I and even like layout, even something like using
right.
Black Express, which I still do, was from that era, kind of that phase of my life
yeah.
where I learned how to do all that stuff. And it was in the early 90s that I started doing more ambitious things. Like I made the newsletter go from like 4 pages to 6 pages to 8 pages to 12 pages. And it gets, you know, I was starting
yeah.
to publish like speeches that when some interesting gay or lesbian person came to Harvard and gave a good speech and had a transcript, I would run the transcript.
Right.
And so it was growing at that point. And at that point, the other thing that was happening, I don't know if you remember a magazine called Christopher Street, which goes back to the 1970s. And that was kind of fading away at that point. And I said, you know, there's got to be kind of a national intelligent forum for the LGBT community. And, so at first it started out as kind of an extension of this newsletter that I was doing. But at some point I said, you know, this should go bigger. This should actually be a magazine that could be read by more people than just Harvard alums. And
yeah.
so we started out as quarterly. We're now bi-monthly, but we started out as quarterly. And so the very first issue probably was basically distributed only to Harvard people. But I think by this time we got to the second issue, we were already expanding and marketing. This was back in the 90s. That was the era of those outright conferences, or in the late 80s and the 90s.
Yeah.
There were
yeah.
those conferences. And I used those kind of to expand our readership. And also writers. Also, it was a great way to recruit writers, which I did at those outright conferences. So that's kind of
yeah.
how it got started. And that's, you know, it's been going ever since.
It so makes sense. And can I also just say something else? Because for those that know about it, I've spoken before. When I was in college, and I'm an English, you know, major through and through, did my grad work in English. But as a minor in my undergrad work, I happened to take anthropology. And it was the best thing I ever did, which unlocked, you know, for me, the idea of every single thing I would ever look at, I would ever try to understand in writing and literature, for me, had to be tied in with both the culture in which it was written, and if it was written to break down, inform, or educate the culture of that day. And so, you know, it gave me this real insightful gift. But then later, when my particular story that, again, and I want to say thank you again, Richard, for giving me the chance to tell part of that story in the, you know, the Healing Stigma in the Age of Social Media piece, which I also will share with our listeners right now. And, Richard, I want to thank you. I think that's a huge part of what got us a literary agent for the book coming
wow.
out. So I'll just say, yeah, there'll be more to say on that, but I wanted to thank you. But in the meantime, here's the
really?
Thing. If it wasn't for the understanding of culture, there wasn't a Healing Stigma program. As you know, it's in, if you want to look at it, go check it out. It's on Richard's Fine Fine site as well. He does a great job for the online edition. But in the meantime, if I didn't have the education and understand culture and how it can both, you know, like apply stigma, and the program wasn't around, and when it happened to me, I literally wouldn't have known what was going on possibly ever, and would have been another, you know, victim and statistic, and terrible as it sounds, you know, like I said, a person who went through something similar for being a victim of on the news first person to at that point to be stigmatized just the month before the episode that aired about me. This gentleman was in law enforcement, went up and put a bullet through his head and committed suicide.
Wow.
You know, so the fact that I had an understanding of culture and anthropology from a caring professor when I was an undergrad, I think in many ways helped save my life later. And yes, I know how to do curricula and, you know, and love to write and read, but I happened to have minored in anthropology, and it came around and was in part what saved my life, because then I understood how stigma, and still make the connections today, how it operates in more than one, you know, form from, you know, sexual orientation to poverty to immigration. I don't mean to, you know, go on and on about it, but I just had to say that. And what you do, I just realized, does take such an informed view, because clearly you haven't lost any of those skills along the way. You've developed them in this, you know, wonderful thing into the review. Again, I know I'm probably saying more than asking questions, but I just realized that. That's just, that's a connection I just made, so I had to share it.
Yeah, you know, I think being trained as a sociologist, I think, is probably the best field I could be trained in, given what I'm doing, because I'm interested in the hard sciences, and we try to cover, you know, the science of homosexuality and obviously politics and political science. But the sociology has been really, really helpful. But one thing I wanted to mention, you know, as a sociologist, one of the great, great sociologists of my, well, let's say my probably my parents' generation, but certainly a person that was extremely influential when I was coming up in this, like the 70s and 80s when I was in graduate school, was a guy named Irving Goffman. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Exactly. Yes.
And, and, of course, he wrote a book called Stigma, which is from the early 1960s, but it's absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's way ahead of its
time. I devoured it. It was one of the first things I started to devour.
Well, the minute you mentioned, you know, the whole, in fact, just the word stigma itself, and then when you mentioned healing stigma, instantly I thought of Irving Goffman because of his extraordinary
influence.
Yeah, oh, good.
It stands on the shoulders. You know, the program, remember this, and here's the thing, and it's not, this is not a sales pitch. I'm just sharing this right now so that, you know, yes, our listeners can get it, but I'm more concerned with having an intelligent conversation in the moment with you, Richard. This is amazing that you touch on that, because for me personally, that's why, remember, I'll just say again, the full book I'm working on with Dr. Robert Gallitzer Levy, he's an amazing today. He's out of the University of Chicago, more than 40 years in the business, forensic psychology, psychiatry, teachers, is a wonderful, wonderful working person in the field of so many things that deal with stigma, right? Now, I trust and have listened to so many others, but I find his energy amazing. And this is the fact. What happened to me makes me a survivor of a high-profile stigmatizing event. Right. And there's no question that the reason why I took a Gaelic word from my collection of poetry is literally because I couldn't find a word in the English language to correctly sum up the feeling I went through. And that word, Riestrad, means half PTSD and half superpower. It's intentionally chosen. So for me, the idea of healing stigma in the book we're working on is a survivor's guide to identity repair in the internet age. That's the full title.
Yeah.
And literally, that is because my experience is something that most people, and I'm not saying it's excellent when people choose to express themselves in the way that they choose, you know, from song to cultural things to scientific studies, whatever it is. But for me personally, I'd been a teacher also for more than two decades, and I had written so many lesson plans. And so when this happened and I didn't see a program out there like it, not only did I understand that books like, you know, Irving Goffman's book were out there, but I also understood that there was no program about, for someone who is stigmatized today, what do you actually do in layman's terms, as well as for communities and organizations, if you want to educate and then have people develop their sensitivity so we reduce stigma. I mean, it's amazing that we know this stuff since was that book published? Maybe 1972? So I'm guessing. I don't know.
Actually, somewhere earlier. I think it was in the early 50s.
Okay. And yet we still don't have it. I'm not lobbying for the book. What I'm saying is we still don't have a book like this out there. That's why I'm so excited to be working on it, is the fact when you compare all of these stigmas that society assigns and look at the amount of problems that it comes back and harms, not only the stigmatized, but communities. I mean, and we know this can go from, you know, race to profession to neighborhood. You know, there's so many different ways that stigma operates. And when you begin to diffuse that and the payoff that happens from it, is the reason why lining up with the best minds I can mind, especially right now with Dr. Levy, it is amazing to be able to do this and stand on those other shoulders, because I truly feel this helps people now and educates people for the future. So, you know, I've written a lot of different things so far, and it's an honor every time I work on it, but this is quite clearly one of those things, those life-changing moments. The lemonade truck dumped it on me, or the lemon truck dumped it on me, and this is the lemonade. And I'm not stealing from Beyonce, because actually Scott knows I've been saying that since since before that album came out. So that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Well, the thing is that, you know, if Goffman, in fact, if I'm right, that it was in the, I think, early 60s that he wrote that book,
yes.
which this wonderful
yeah.
book, Stigma. We are now in a totally different world. And that's one
right.
reason that I gave your piece the title, which I think I hope you agree that kind of captures what it's
absolutely.
All about, is
absolutely.
Being stigmatized in the age of social media, which is something that
right.
Goffman could not have anticipated. The book is all about how people prevent being stigmatized if they have
right.
what he called a discreditable stigma. But then
right.
also very much like, what do you do if you do become stigmatized? And remember, I mean, he wrote this long before Stonewall, long before the gay rights
right.
movement. So he didn't even address being gay. It was like a classic case of stigma that you can hide it, right? It can be
right.
it can be what he called a stigmatizable it can be, I mean, a, sorry,
well, he does write about it.
Stigma.
He does write about it, but he writes about it in a very dated way in terms of it being a mental illness.
Oh,
that's why other things in there are so dated. It's so, no, because
I've read it recently. Oh, I bet.
And
it's been years since I read it, yeah.
And it's not the fact that I don't think he – and this is the thing. It's and that's, again, where I understand a little bit about that idea of understanding anthropology, that when I read it, I knew it was dated. People had warned me it was dated. But I needed to go back and read what was out there because I'm that curious. I had to see how this developed because, you know, I'm curious about language, how that word – and you know it as well, Richard, how I share a fascination of Greece, you know, in the culture that comes from there, the language. But, you know, we go all the way back to the root of that word and the mark that was made – on people that were, you know, then branded literally as an outsider for crime, for, you know, some kind of, you know, distasteful thing that the rest of society chose not to want to associate with them anymore. And that word and that action is still around and it develops. And of course, something like the internet, social media becomes, it's just you know, fodder, or it becomes, you know, fuel for the fire. It's there and the spark just makes it go and it runs fast.
Well,
runs
that's
fast.
The thing. I mean, the social media have just created a whole new world that gives people, it's just democratized gossip, basically, and the
well
ability
said.
Of people to stigmatize in a way that certainly Goffman could not have foreseen back in the 1960s. And it's a problem. I mean, I think you've hit upon something which, boy, you're not alone. I mean, I don't have too much contact with, let's say, young people, teenagers and people in their 20s, but it's a jungle out there from what I can understand.
Yeah.
The way in which, God, high school kids and college kids can really just destroy one another by spreading false rumors and stigmatizing each other in ways that have no basis in reality whatsoever. And yet, everyone now has that megaphone. Everyone has that
and a digital identity.
Put
a digital identity that they feel important about. That's for, you know, remember, for someone who's younger still, their digital identity can mean even more than someone who's an adult and kind of grew up at a time when there wasn't as much activity or there wasn't a Facebook. You know what I'm saying? These kids are growing up with it, and it means everything to them. So when something harmful, you know, cyberbullying is real, and it has consequences that are horrendous.
Absolutely, cyberbullying. I didn't use the phrase, but I'm glad you did, because that's what it's all about, and that's certainly it goes on in a way that is just, oh, God, I mean, what do you do? I mean, well, that's exactly what you're about, and you're healing stigma is what do you do when you are just like, you know, falsely accused or raked over the mud by people, and now suddenly, you know, it's out there, and it's a real problem. I mean, I think you have identified something that, and I wish you the best of luck, by the way.
Thank you.
In this program, because I don't know, like, what kind of, I'm sure you've gotten a pretty good response, because it really is something that has affected an awful lot of people. And I think we're still in the early stages of social media, even though they've been around, it's been around for a while, that we're still trying, you know, groping our way and trying to figure out, well, how, you know, what do you do? How do you deal with a situation?
Well, imagine now,
just
for a sec, imagine this for the psyche, right, for the developing psyche of what social media means. There is now a generation growing up in which even the information from their baby monitors is going to be smart information that downloads into the cloud. And so from the moment you're born, almost, there is going to be already created this digital identity of yours. Now, what happens if that identity is harmed in some way? is hacked in some way, is exposed in some way that shows the rest of the community suddenly something that they consider to be unfitting and they don't want to associate with, bang, in 1 second you are stigmatized online. And is that
wow.
any worse than, you know, stigmatized in person for someone who's grown up with an online digital identity? And that's another part of what I'm working with. And yeah, I
wow.
mean, it grows every day in importance. That's where I take the pride of doing it and the energy to do it. But the one thing I can say here honestly is it doesn't matter age, it doesn't matter economic background. Stigma has been around for a long time, and there are a few people that actually have figured out what it is about, but there hasn't been a huge contribution to it. There's a lot of very good people out there now that want to end it and are running programs to educate about what it is, and I'm so proud and support every single one of them. But what I can honestly say is the idea of healing those that are stigmatized right now across this, you know, gamut is something that I find more and more calling every day for and need for. So that's why, you know, we're doing the book. And here's what I'll tell you, Richard. I'll be glad to write in the future. Whenever something comes up about it, I'll be your stigma pen. But I'll also, when the book, hopefully, knock on wood, and we have more good news to share, we'll get it reviewed or whatever. I would enjoy, obviously, anytime being part of what I consider to be, as you said, one of the most informed conversations for our Rainbow community today. And I like what you're doing online. And that's the good thing, by the way. That's how you fight negative things in social media and digital identities, is finding out where you can trust good information and being part of a good community online. And I like what you're doing online for the publication as well. And that'll get you younger readers, I think.
Well, let's hope.
Richard, now that you're...
Yeah, Scott, go ahead.
You've been doing over 10,000 editions at a time of print editions going out to largely your subscription base, but you also do a lot to different other places that carry them. But talk about how social media is impacting. It's impacting publishing everywhere. How is it affecting you guys personally? And tell me about your digital and how you feel that's coming along. And is it a preference of yours, or is it one of those necessary evil type things?
It's interesting. It's kind of both, and it's a complicated question because, you know, of course, we do have a digital presence. We have a digital edition, which I think where we
it's
have
nice.
Maybe a only, we have like a couple hundred people who download and, you know, who have actually bought the digital edition, so they use it on their on their iPad or their Kindle or whatever. But that's a small number. I mean, as you say, we have 10,000 or so copies produced of each issue in hard copy. And fortunately, we have been able to keep that number more or less stable. Maybe it's dropped a little bit over the last few years, and I think we can attribute most of that drop, if not all of it, to the internet and the fact that there's just so much information there. And I have to admit that I myself am, you know, a huge consumer of internet information. So although I still like a hard copy magazine, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah.
10 years ago, people predicted that we wouldn't be around. That, you know, magazines, hard copy magazines, and books were dying, and everybody would be just downloading, and we would all be using our Kindle or our iPad, and magazines were a thing of the past, and same with books. But it hasn't happened. Maybe it still will, and I think nobody is, you know, resting on our laurels. But it seems that people do have a fondness for hard copy. You know, you mentioned earlier, Kevin, that the magazine, the GLR, is well edited, and I really appreciate that because I do spend a lot of time on every article. And I think that's the difference. I think the reason that we've survived is because if you look at a magazine, like a really great magazine like The New Yorker, my new copy just came today, and I could cite, you know, quite a few other magazines that I think are extremely well done, Scientific American, have been around for years. Magazines that are really well done, are really well edited, and you just don't find that kind of quality on the internet, in my opinion. I love Huffington Post. I love Politico. I'm a political junkie. I read all that stuff, but it's very ephemeral. And if you look at the article, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that pops up on like Queer Voices in Huffington Post that I wouldn't publish. It's just not edited enough. It's not good enough. You know, it needs to be shortened and refined and honed. And so I think that's our niche. And the way that we've survived is by trying to create just a really good old-fashioned magazine that's well-edited, I think there's a lot of pressure now to make it sort of more, I don't know, flashy in a way, or more of a beautiful object that people really want to own and hold and possess. And so we've tried to do that. And so I think magazines are a lot better looking now than they used to be, simply because they have to compete with the internet. But there still seems to be a niche for us out there. So here,
well, can I tell you one thing? Can I throw out another huge compliment, not to embarrass, but to tell? I mean, I didn't tell you this before, Richard, but on my way to the White House this week, the one thing I brought to read en route was the election 2016 of the GNLR Review. On the way to Washington, I wanted to save that. And it was brilliant because for me personally, number one, I like still getting a hard copy in the mail. I so look forward to it. Yeah, I'll still check things out online, of course. But when I had to go do something and I was caught in a way that I didn't feel like just swiping a screen or whatever, nothing against that for those who look at it on their handhelds. I am not criticizing. But when I was sitting down to relax with a cup of coffee the way I liked it en route to the White House, traveling, I kicked back and read that, and things like, can I just say, like, things like and I'm just not giving anything away here. I want our people to go out and download it or subscribe it in any way. But like, from the Prince's legacy, along with illustrations, along with the colors, along with what's there, the information, to things like the article about Abraham Lincoln. And then the LGBT vote and swinging an election. These things are so timely. And then when I had the chance to sit down and read something that wasn't just a quick, you know, either a soundbite or a keyword search, it was like a breath of fresh air. And then I was able to go to the White House and go to the celebration and, you know, do my presentation feeling literally like I had been in the presence of intelligent conversations. And it just made for a great bridge to go into the room where there were live, brilliant, intelligent conversations going on. And so that's what prepped me for it. It was your addition.
Cool to hear that. I'm glad we played it. Because that's, I mean, it sounds extremely exciting what you did at the White House. And congratulations, by the way, on being able to
do
that.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, not to forget, just on this issue, you mentioned, I think, a number of the
go, what else? Which, what else has you excited?
Well, the Barney Frank. I think Barney Frank is somebody I just wanted to put in just mention his name because he's been so supportive and he's been so great. He has written for every election issue. This is a tradition. We do an election issue September, October, every 4 years. And so this is the one that's out on the stands right now. And every one so far, Barney Frank has written an article for us. Of course,
I have a personal connection to him. You know, I have a personal connection for me personally,
Massachusetts.
He doesn't know this, but I have a. I don't know, but here's the thing that I love. I, as an undergrad, am a Husky alum here in Boston. I went to Northeastern. Even though most of the people there go for engineering, I was, as you heard already, I was an English major and an anthropology minor at this huge engineering school. So it was an amazing, amazing thing for me.
It's a liberal arts, you know.
When I went there, people just looked at you like, oh, you poor kid, you can't do math. But anyway, I will never forget that after Barney Frank came out the next year or very shortly afterwards, he was due to speak as the speaker at Northeastern. And he delivered, and it was the year before I believe I graduated or something like that. I was there as a student, I believe, but I still remember him coming and delivering that speech, even though it wasn't my graduation yet. I remember saying, oh my God, if we get a speaker that good for our grad, and it was so wonderful what he did at that time so early on for the whole entire community. And again, I mean, I was in the presence already of watching people that were breaking down doors of stigma in their own way. And so, I love
Barney. Barney's wonderful. He gives a great speech, and he's very funny. Yeah. I mean, the thing about him, he's very deadpan, but he's very funny. I mean, you know, he can really have.
But
a
he gets
room,
his point
you know,
across
outlet.
With that humor. He gets his point across with that humor as well, which is great. Yeah.
Oh yeah,
I agree.
He absolutely does. He's actually been kind enough to come and do some fundraising for us. Not recently, but back in the 90s, kind of when we needed it most, and maybe the early 2000s. I think he came here and did three fundraisers where he was kind enough come and.
Well, I wanted to comment on that as well. Like you said, people don't know that he's funny and he is warm and does those kind of charitable things. He actually came to me. I was the chairman of our Pride Center here in Northeast Ohio, and he had a Democratic fundraiser he was doing for the county that I'm in. And so I called his staff and asked if he would mind coming by my Pride Center and doing a short little speech. He came, did a half an hour, met there for another 25 minutes. He's just amazing. I got to shake his hand and thank him for coming. But he is just that
That's cool.
of a person where
he's,
something he believes in, it's just, he's just 100% behind you. So it's really
he's,
cool.
He's actually from my home state of New Jersey. He's from Hudson County. I'm from Essex County, so which are neighboring more or less. And Hudson County has a reputation of being like really machine politics, democratic politics. And he's talked about how he realized, you know, he's not going to make it in that world. One reason that he came to Massachusetts, well, he went to Harvard. I guess that's what got him to Massachusetts. And he's like me, he stayed once he got here. But he always jokes about how he's a Jewish, left-handed, gay.
Yeah.
And I think there's something else. I think even the kid from Jersey.
He always ends on that kid from Jersey. You're right.
Kid
you
from
nailed
Jersey,
it.
I know. So every possible stigma. No, all of these are possible stigmas, right? I mean.
So what
he has overcome, I think, is really quite amazing. That and he even has a little bit of a speech impediment. I mean, if the truth be told, right? He doesn't speak quite as clearly as. And so he's overcome. I mean, it's amazing that he's brilliant, of course.
And he delivers a hell of a speech. You're right.
And he
with
delivers
the
a hell of a speech.
He goes,
Yes, I know. He does. Yeah. And, he gets his point across. He keeps you laughing. And he also is, fairly profound in his observations about the world.
His essay, by the way, in the latest issue, you're right, because it kicked off right in the beginning, I think. I think it's up close to the front. So that's probably one of the reasons why I didn't mention. But, his essay is awesome.
I think it's the lead
article,
What's at stake.
Isn't it? It's what's at stake in this election, especially for
all
the
three
rainbow
branches.
Community.
And he
says,
all three branches are at stake. He couldn't be more
brilliant
correct
essay.
About that. I point out in my little essay in the beginning, we're a nonprofit. Actually, the GLR is a nonprofit organization, so we don't endorse candidates, and we don't take certain kinds of political positions. But I suppose our politics are fairly transparent. And the fact that Barney is a big supporter and he's in every issue, so I guess I don't have to pull any punches about who we're rooting for in the election.
Sanity.
Yeah,
we're
sanity,
rooting for sanity.
We're rooting for sanity. Yeah, and
we want to continue an intelligent conversation, not end it.
I know. I thought Hillary did great the other day. I was very pleased to see that she's.
Oh my God! Can I share the funniest story about this? This is you guys will appreciate this. So I'm coming back after DC now because and this is wonderful as well because things are so heated up, both with the Healing Stigma program and with writing and everything else right now. I was literally only in DC for about a work day, about 8 hours. And so turning around, waiting in line to come back afterwards, and it was wonderful being there, being at the White House. I was standing there with another gentleman, and we're both fairly quiet, waiting in line, doing our thing. We had our little personal space worked out, nodded to each other, yeah, it's the right line, okay. And there was another line where there was a bunch of angry people because it looked like whatever they were waiting for, they didn't know whether it was a boat, a train, or a plane, but it was really late. By that point, they didn't care, right? So in our line, everyone was pretty civil. Then this woman comes up, and she has her handheld set cranked up really loud, and we were in line at the exact same time that the debate was going on. All right?
Yeah,
so
we're trying, really?
both of us obviously were trying not to listen at first because we wanted to listen to the whole thing when we got home later. So literally, I was traveling home from the White House, not able to see the debate because of the timing of all this. And suddenly, both this other gentleman and I are leaning in, and we start listening. We couldn't help it because he's blaring for this woman. And already, I could see us both kind of laughing. And we could tell by the way we were laughing what our politics were. And even though we didn't exchange more than a word or two, we were both like, I just couldn't help but listen for a second. He's like, I know. He says, I told my wife not to tell me anything when I get home. I just want to hit play and watch it.
Oh my gosh!
But it was amazing. It was surreal. So, what did you think?
Oh well, I thought it was. My gosh! It just sort of confirms everything we knew. I mean, Trump was utterly incoherent. He can't put a sentence. He can't even. Oh, I was going to say he can't put a paragraph together. He can't even put a sentence together. I just thought it was an extraordinary bad performance from Trump and an extraordinarily wonderful performance by Hillary. There was just no comparison between the two. I really hope that it will make a difference in the final result.
Fingers crossed.
But my gosh, I mean, we really are at nail biting time here for the next 6 weeks. Is it 6 weeks or 5 weeks?
Scott knows. He's a political machine. He comes from a political family that's a political machine in a good way.
I know. So,
hey, but you know what? Did you guys hear the incredible part that could hear? I know I'm talking about stigma again, but seriously, stigma could be another turning point in this campaign. And the thing that gets me is, imagine in all of these things, one of the things I am really also honored to be working on is to help and kind of put forward this idea of the damage, body stigma, weight stigma, obesity stigma, all these different stigmas that have to do with how people feel about their bodies and therefore can lead to further harm. This isn't about telling someone what to be or how to live their life. This is literally how you picture yourself within your own mind. These stigmas are terrible, and they're getting worse when we look at what advertising tells people, especially young people, to be, right? And in the middle of all of this, the thing that I couldn't believe was – and then the next day, as far as I can see, is Trump doubling down on the fact that he imagine in this day and age, someone running for president would call out a Miss Universe for being, for weight stigma, and then call in reporters and publicly embarrass. And this, what that does.
You know what? I truly had not thought of that before. But when you think,
I'm trained.
It all together, all of the name calling. All of the groups that he has insulted, obviously the overweight most recently, but handicapped people also he has, not to mention, gay people, recent immigrants and Hispanics and Muslims and people based on their religion. I mean, it really
it's
is
the ultimate playground bully trying to get, the ultimate playground bully trying to get the most amount of the crowd to say, look, we're okay. As this desperate attempt of being unprepared. I mean, here's the other thing I loved. I always love to go outside of the U.S. sometimes as well to get the news. And there was an article, I think it was the BBC, that was saying, look, here's what happens when a prepared politician, who also is, remember, a talented lawyer, prepares for what is for her a professional outing compared to flying by, the seat of your pants. And I mean, seriously, she is a very good, very – you can't talk about personality here because that's too subjective for me. Someone – but, for me, the amazing part is how Trump will continue to talk about a woman's looks, which he can't talk about stamina. He tries to keep avoiding that, but he said her look is not presidential after what he said about women. And then on top of it, doubles down on what he said about a Miss Universe. For me personally, what I do in the work of, with stigma and trying to educate people, that just fascinates me that, as people recognize that could be a turning point. Because certainly I loved, as a follow-up to that, and I want to recognize here now that it is Alicia Machado. There's a person here.
Yeah.
There's not a stigma here.
Oh, that's
and
great.
She's more than a Miss Universe. She's a talented, smart woman who now happens to be a U.S. citizen and is showing that she's very excited to vote. She's registered. Everyone out there, make sure you are registered. That's a lovely, lovely turning point here, and communicating that is wonderful.
There's an interesting sort of tipping point that's reached, and maybe this is something that you've thought about before, but somebody like Trump, who I agree he's a school ground bully, and he starts insulting various groups, and that's the classic bully thing. You get people on your side, and you gang up on the weaker person, and then that's how you become sort of the big man, is by sort of being the leader of this pack. But there's a point at which if you start bullying everybody and calling everybody by names, there aren't very many people left who can be your supporters. I mean, I would say more than half of Americans struggle with their weight, probably. So when he starts insulting people who are overweight, I mean, come on.
And look at him. I don't mean to be critical, but look at him. Donald Trump isn't pulling his shirt up to show his six-pack.
He's not exactly
the man is a human being, but, I mean, really, this is amazing that you could do that, not only in this day and age, but to do it as a man to a woman talking about body size?
It's unbelievable. I know,
they want to be a public servant on behalf of all Americans? Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then what was that weird comment that he made about talking about the hacking? Well, it might not have been Russia, it might not have been China, or it might have been Russia or China, but it might have been a 450-pound person sitting on their bed. What was that?
Yeah.
That was,
again, you're
that
right.
Was,
I didn't think of it. You're right.
Weird.
Yeah.
I mean,
it was very weird.
It was fat shaming, but it was also just weird. It was like absolutely no idea where he pulled that from. Who is he referring to? But yeah. That was kind of part and parcel of
Then again, movie. Here's a crazy thing that I have noticed, and that's not right. Crazy is not – when I get tired here, we may have to cut that out, Scott, because I have to stop using that for mental illness. And I always say it when I don't mean to say it. The ironic thing here is that oftentimes those that stigmatize are actually bringing out a fear in themselves, and that's why they want to show how much they are part of the group. So in a lot of these things, when he's talking about a person's looks, right – imagine this, to someone who's a businessman who thinks it's all just about sealing the deal. That must be so important to him, right? That must be so important to him. Whereas, I mean, let's face it, and Scott, you can answer this one as well, my friend. You know this because Scott just was there for a Hillary rally, is the fact that being rested and prepared, not just for the campaign, but for the job ahead, I think is what Hillary is doing, and I respect that so much, despite how close this is, and we want her to pull it out. She's preparing for the job, not just for looking good for the handshake and the, you know, the sign on the dotted line, and let's get this deal done so I can go back to Key Largo.
Right, well, she said that as much in the debate as well, too. She said that, yes, I am prepared for the debate as well as I'm preparing for the presidency, and I think that was one of her best moments in the debate, because she didn't bring that
out.
That
was indeed, yes, because he sort of accused her of like, as if that's like cheating, like preparing for the debate was kind of like cheating.
Right.
And he's like, no, that's what you do.
Yeah. Hey, did you guys see her on the plane?
This away from politics, of all things. I don't want to pull away from politics, but we're running out of time here.
Charming.
All right.
I want to bring
it back to Richard here. I want to talk a little bit because we were talking about it is being a nonprofit. You guys actually take donations. Talk about your website, because I think it's a great website. Talk about how they can donate. Talk about how writers can actually submit articles to you, and talk about donating to the site. So
our website is it's www.glreview.com or .org. Sorry, we used to be, but now it's .org. So it's I'll do that one more time. www.glreview.org, and it's all there. You can find out how to subscribe. I think might be the first step. Our donors are almost always our readers. People who have been subscribers and who like the magazine, and so that's usually the first step. And if they discover that they like and support the magazine, they realize that our revenue stream from subscriptions and advertising is not enough to keep us going. That's when people decide to become donors, and we have a large number of active donors, and we couldn't do it without them. As many nonprofit organizations will tell you, especially in the arts, you know, we have a magazine that you can buy on the newsstands, or you can subscribe, and so we do have and you could advertise, and so we do have a revenue stream like any other company, but we're also a nonprofit, so people do make donations, and you'll find a place on our website where you can do that. And then you mentioned
the writers' guidelines,
writers, and you'll also find on the website writers' guidelines and information about how to submit material. And we're very open. We're always looking for more writers and more people who can write for the magazine.
I'm living proof.
Absolutely.
We're in the same town, and literally all this work was going on, but it was through the website that I think we found each other. So this is really one of those things where social media so helps when you're in a busy schedule and things are going on like that, and I'm traveling or whatever. The website is wonderful, and again, I love the art. I just want to say I love the color, I love the artwork and everything else that is more than just the articles as well as the articles. A good production online is also an amazing thing. So please donate if you can to it. It's a really worthy thing. This is a conversation we need to keep going into the future. It's really important how it fits into the general society. It really is.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. I should mention that we have this wonderful artist named Charles Heffling who does the illustrations, and he's been with us for years, many years. He's fabulous. He used to do black and white line drawings, but he's switched over to color partly because of us. He's completely changed his style in many ways. Yeah, because now, you know, printing has actually become much less expensive than it used to be, and it's possible to do color. So we're now a full color magazine with lots of these great illustrations from Charles.
Oh, they're beautiful.
Yeah, as well as
when
you were photos
talking earlier about
and
New York or your New Yorker subscription, that reminds me of the New York Saturday Evening Post, all those Norman Rockwell. I just went to Norman Rockwell. I had lunch today in Stockbridge, and I just think the illustrations does make it a keepsake, which
yeah.
why people
oh, yeah.
do like it to have in their hands as well.
Yeah.
Yes, which is not, it wasn't so much a feature of the early magazine, but, you know, as I said, with the internet and all of the online magazines that are available, we have moved along, I think, with many other magazines to feel that, you know, it has to be kind of like a beautiful object. You want to hold on to this magazine and take it to bed with you. And
yeah.
so we've tried to make it something like that. I'm somebody who loves to curl up with a book or a magazine in bed. So, this,
yeah.
you know.
Or on the road. I just got to say, it worked for me on the road.
When traveling, yep. absolutely, yeah.
Yep.
That's right.
But and I
when
love, by
guys,
the way, now I did look, it
a...
was his illustration of Prince as well that I was already commenting on before you even mentioned who did it. So hats off to him because I love the illustration of Prince in this issue.
Yeah.
It's great. It's great.
Yeah,
it really is.
Definitely.
And you guys also are on social media with Facebook and Tumblr as well, I believe, correct?
We are, yes. I don't know about Tumblr, but we certainly have a presence on Facebook. My partner Stephen is the one who does that. I should give a little plug for Stephen because the two of us were partners in our personal lives and also business partners. I'm the editor, and Stephen does most of the business work, and he takes care of our website and our Facebook and our social media. So, Stephen is there, kind of working on social media, and we do indeed have a presence.
And
you're
both workaholics.
Check us out there.
You're both workaholics, which I love.
I wish I were more of one, but I guess I am. I'm enough of one.
I think
that
you
I'm
are.
To, I'm, yeah, well, I mean, it's a lot of work, I will tell you. I only have to get this magazine out once every 2 months, but it's about all I can do. And thank God for Stephen to take care of all the other stuff that I just
That's
would not
fine.
Have time for.
Yeah.
Okay. Stay on the line for us, Richard. We're going to be taking a quick break here. You're listening to Healing Stigma on Left of Straight Radio. We've been talking to Richard Schneider from the Gay and Lesbian Review Worldwide. We're going to play a little bit of Matt Van Fossen, Time Ain't What It Used to Be, and Kevin and I will be back to wrap it up in just a couple of minutes.
Forever to come, and you couldn't watch TV until your homework was done. Look, time ain't what it used to be. And waiting for that first kiss, it took an
And we are back. That was Matt Van Fossen with Time Ain't What It Used to Be. Another great interview, Kevin. Thank you so much.
Oh, my goodness. That was really, really fun. I think Richard is, you know, here's the thing. I already love the publication, of course, but what he's got a great radio voice. He just was enthusiastic. He's got the energy. And I just think people like that are so fun to talk to. It's a pleasure.
Exactly. And to let our listeners know, we did talk to him off air. He is actually giving one of our listeners a year subscription to their View. How cool is that?
Yeah,
so be sure to check our website. Go to www.healingstigmaradio.com. We'll have the information up there, you know, within about the next 4 to 5 days. Here, we'll see how we can do it. We're kind of booked right now. But we'll get it up there for you, and we'll find out how you can receive your own one-year subscription to the Gay and Lesbian Review, which is
that's
really
so
cool
generous
thing.
Of him. Really cool.
Yeah.
Really cool.
Awesome.
What a great guy.
Well, we have a lot to talk about. So much stuff going on in the next couple of weeks. We have some great shows lined up for everyone. I'm going to be road tripping here. You and I are going to actually probably hopefully meet in the next couple of days here, which will be fantastic.
That'd be
fun. You have a lot of stuff going. There's no stopping, no rest for the wicked here. From Washington, D.C., you got a lot of stuff happening this week, right?
Oh, absolutely. It really, it's just, you know, it happens all the time. But, I mean, here's the one thing that I have to say. You're on the road, and you're doing wonderful things on the road, and we'll get all of these shows out. Naturally, we want to keep going with all this. But the interest, the people that are reaching out. I had people in Washington from the Native American community asking for the Groovalotto show, which I know we got to get out there. Which still, it's some technical difficulty. Is that what's going on or something?
Right. We have some trouble.
We had a glitch.
We put it together through Blog Talk, and it kind of blew apart. And I didn't keep the audio, the original audio for it. So I'm having trouble trying to recover it for myself first. I'll recover it from Blog Talk. Between the two of us, we're going to get this done. But we're going to have it back up there as soon as possible.
Well, no, the interest is there.
By the time you're back.
You know,
yeah,
I can tell you, there's even people,
fantastic interview.
There's all these different communities that are taking part in listening to what I think Healing Stigma Radio does so well. But, you know, here's the next thing. This is the kind of show that if you can just give me one chance to bring up one more thing, if I could use the end of this show for me to bring out one more thing from the news about the power of word and expression, right?
Sure.
Can you imagine in the town of Charlotte right now that a 9-year-old girl could use the power of the English language the way, and I want to say her name right, I hope for you, it is Ziana Oliphant. Did you hear her speech to, I think it was the city council in Charlotte, a 9-year-old girl talking about the violence in that city against black lives?
I've heard about it, but I haven't got to hear it itself.
Watch
yet,
it.
I have heard about
watch
it.
Watch it. We'll get the link up or whatever, but watch what this young girl in an unplanned, apparently, way says about why we need our mummies and our daddies. It is an if your heart doesn't break, you don't have a heart. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
I know I had spoken
I
before
wait.
When the and you know what? This is people like and I know people may not like what he did, and I even was thinking about the uniforms in the game, but Kaepernick I think tweeted to her about her courage. That what he does is not, you know, is one thing. Writing to her about her courage.
That's fantastic.
Is truly a movement of language and expression. And yes, I'll come back now and look at all the other people that are looking at the ability to do peaceful protest to make sure people of color feel safe in this country. Does not in any way take away from all of us feeling safe in this country, but it is a courageous and powerful effort that's going on. And I was in the room, by the way, if you listen to the very end, one of our grand dames, doms, however it is said, of the bisexual movement. Lorraine Hutchins was in the room, and she spoke about how many years ago her grandmother marched in Washington to get women's right to vote, and how when she was a young girl, her mother brought her to the same spot, and she listened to a speech by Martin Luther King, and that's when she realized Black Lives Matter.
That's amazing.
You know,
and
seriously, so I'm just so powerfully, you know, still energized to do the work all this week and obviously get together with you, my friend. But a 9-year-old girl is what makes my brain, you know, go sparkle even after this wonderful conversation with Richard. The bravery of Ziana Oliphant. Go check it out. Be moved and let the power of words educate you every day. I think it's a wonderful thing to have language not as a weapon but as a power to heal.
Amen to that. Well, please check that out, everybody. I'm going to look it up myself. Thanks for listening to us. Of course, you can always follow us on social media at Heal Stigma Radio on Twitter and the Healing Stigma Radio website at healingstigmaradio.com and on Facebook, Healing Stigma Radio. If you haven't downloaded the app yet, go to your app store at your iPhone or Android. Just type in Left to Straight Radio, and it's for free. So thanks so much for listening to us. Kevin, it's been great talking to you. You have a great week.
Hey, welcome to the neighborhood. I'm so glad you're in New England. We'll see you soon, all right, my friend? To both you and your mom, have fun.
England. All right. You've been listening to Left Straight Radio. Everyone have a great night. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.